Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Do you see how Solomon would rationalize this? Well, listen, I'm importing horses from Egypt, but I'm not doing it for myself. I'm not breaking God's command. I'm just acting as a middleman. This is just a business transaction. Do you see how this way of rationalizing sin had probably taken place in Solomon's life? Rationalize sin.
Whenever we hear about King Solomon, we often think of him as Israel's most wealthy and wisest ruler. Just the sheer mention of his accumulated wealth on an annual basis is enough to put his greatness into perspective. Unfortunately, with all of our focus typically put on his riches and wisdom, we often end up missing just how much he compromised. In today's message, Pastor David reflects on the compromise of Solomon, which ultimately resulted in his downfall. In our study, we learn how our rationalization of sin will always get the best of us. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord has loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. You see, the Queen of Sheba heard these wonderful things about Solomon and his kingdom, but upon seeing it with her own eyes, she realized that it was greater than she had ever heard. You know, it's rare for that to happen today. You know, we live in a day today when things are exaggerated and hyped and made to seem so great when they're, well, it's okay. It's very rare when we come to something and say, you know, I heard this was good, but when I'm here, I see that it's far greater than I had ever heard. And so she says, listen, happy are your men and happy are these your servants. It was a joyful thing for them to serve a great and wise and rich king. It was a happy thing to serve Solomon. By the way, shouldn't we drop what? You could make a good sermon out of this right here. If it was a happy thing to serve Solomon, how much of a happier thing should it be to serve Jesus Christ? I mean, isn't that just the truth? It should be a much, much happier thing to serve Jesus Christ than it ever was to serve Solomon. And then she says, blessed be the Lord your God who has delighted in you. And this is an example of what God wanted to do for Israel under the promises of the old covenant. She goes away saying, blessed be the Lord. God promised Israel that if they obeyed under the old covenant, he would bless them so tremendously that the world would take notice and that they would give glory to the God of Israel. And that's exactly what the Queen of Sheba is doing. Let me read you from Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 1 and 10. It says, now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. Then all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. You see, God said, I want to bless you so much because of your obedience that the nations of the earth would take notice. This reminds us that though God chose Israel, he chose them to be a way that he reached the nations. He wanted to reach the nations through Israel. He didn't want the choosing and the blessing to stop with Israel. And so she says, blessed be the Lord your God. Now, you want to get into a pretty good Bible debate? Here's a Bible debate. Was the Queen of Sheba saved? When she says, blessed be the Lord your God, is that a confession of faith unto salvation? It's a fair question. Taken in the context, I don't think you can say that these words prove that she was converted. Taken in context, I don't think you can say that this says, I forsake the gods that I knew about in Sheba, and now I will serve the Lord and him alone. I don't think you can say that. No, this may be nothing more than the queen's response to the amazing blessing that was very evident in Solomon's Jerusalem. I want you to think about the Queen of Sheba and her response here for a minute, because I think that she is a great illustration of something facing Christians and the church right now today. And that's the whole business of tailoring what we do as a church, you know, making, fashioning, modeling what we do for the seeker. Don't you think the Queen of Sheba is a great example of a seeker? I mean, she really is. Matter of fact, we can admire the way that she sought. She came from a very great distance. She came with gifts to bring. Isn't that great? Wouldn't you love it if people who came and sought that, they came with gifts? She came with questions, and she came to learn. She came and she saw the riches of the king. She came and she stayed for an extended period. She came telling everything that was on her heart, and she came and brought a bunch of people with her. And I tell you, that is like the ideal seeker. You couldn't want a better seeker than the Queen of Sheba. And as a matter of fact, Jesus used the Queen of Sheba as an example of a seeker. Let me read to you from Matthew chapter 12, verse 42. The Queen of the South, that means the Queen of Sheba, the Queen of the South will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed, a greater than Solomon is here. Jesus' whole point was that if the Queen of Sheba sought Solomon and the splendor of his kingdom so diligently, how much more should people seek Jesus today and the glory of his kingdom? And believe me, she will rise up in judgment of this generation. But if we take the Queen of Sheba as an example of a seeker, we see that Solomon impressed her with his wealth and his splendor. And he also impressed her spiritually. The whole thing of the Queen of Sheba was like, wow, this is amazing. I never saw buildings like this. I never saw people like this. I never saw glory like this. It's all wonderful. She was very impressed. She was very touched personally. But she went home apparently unsaved. Now, doesn't that have something to teach us about the seeker-sensitive movement here? I mean, really. Now, it's wonderful that she was impressed. We don't think it's a bad thing that she was impressed by the material glory and the personality of Solomon. But at the end of the day, it seems that there was something missing spiritually in Solomon to come and connect with the Queen of Sheba. Again, I'm just guessing here, all right? I'm just guessing that if the Queen of Sheba had visited David, David would have done something different with her. David would have connected with her in a way that Solomon did not. This shows that impressing seekers with facilities and programs and organization and professionalism, it might be good, but it's not enough. You have to touch them with the Spirit of God. They need something from heaven. It's great if you impress seekers with all the other things, but listen, they need something from heaven to touch them. And it seems that this is what Solomon lacked. Well, he didn't come out the loser for it, though. Take a look here, verse 10. Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold, spices in great quantity, and precious stones. There never came again such abundance of spices as the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Also, the ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought great quantities of almug wood and precious stone from Ophir. And the king made steps of the almug wood for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, also harps and stringed instruments for singers. There never again came such almug wood, nor has the like been seen to this day. Now King Solomon also gave the Queen of Sheba all she desired, whatever she asked, besides what Solomon had given her according to the royal generosity. So she turned and went to her own country, she and her servants. Now, the Queen of Sheba came from a region that was rich in spices and in fine woods. So it made sense that these were the gifts that she brought to King Solomon. You got to love the phrase that it uses here. Solomon had given her according to the royal generosity. Now, if you're giving according to the royal generosity of Solomon, you're giving a lot, aren't you? It's like saying, I'm giving you according to the generosity of, you know, Bill Gates or of the guy who owns IKEA or whatever. You know, thinking, wow, that's a lot of money. It also shows the generosity of God towards us, doesn't it? And when God gives to us, doesn't he give to us out of his royal generosity? It's a great measure that God gives towards us. Now, I don't want to leave the Queen of Sheba without making one more just little side point here. There's a tradition. It's just a legend. Don't believe it. Don't believe what I'm about to tell you. They're really just fanciful stories. That the Queen of Sheba, when she visited, she wanted a son by Solomon. And so Solomon obliged her and gave her a son. Her child was named Menelech, and he became the ancestor of all subsequent Ethiopian monarchs. And, of course, the ancestor of a certain Ethiopian eunuch who was saved in the book of Acts. All right, you didn't believe that, did you? It's just a legend. So let's get back to the Bible instead of just legends. Verse 14. Let me just recap here. We are left again with another story that impresses us about Solomon, but yet there's something missing. There's something not there. Now look at verse 14. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traveling merchants, from the income of traders, from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. 666 talents of gold. This vast amount of gold came to Solomon yearly. One commentator that I read, he set the value of these talents of gold at $281 million a year that Solomon made on this. And this wasn't the end of it. First of all, that was just his income from the gold. And that wasn't, secondly, all the gold that he got in. This speaks not only to the great wealth of Solomon. I mean, when you're making $281 million a year, you're doing pretty good. But it also speaks to the fact that Solomon is the only other person mentioned in the Bible associated with the number 666. Of course, the other person biblically connected to this number, 666, is the end times world dictator and opponent of God and his people, often known as the Antichrist. That's in Revelation chapter 13. In fact, the book of Revelation passage says that the number 666, is the number of a man. And when you read that, you have to wonder, is the man Solomon? Could have it been written instead in Revelation that 666 is the number of Solomon? It's the number of a man, and that man is Solomon. He's the only other person with whom this number, 666, is mentioned or associated with in the entire Bible. Now, what does that tell us? I don't think it means that Solomon was the Antichrist, or that somehow the coming Antichrist will be, you know, the reincarnation of Solomon or something like that. No, no, no. But I think it tells us something. And we would only know this knowing what we know in Revelation. It may indicate that the Antichrist may not be someone purely evil from the beginning. That's, of course, always how he's pictured in the movies, right? You know, the movies, The Omen, you know, the other end times movies, the Antichrist, you know, just looking at the guy, you know, he's devilish from the very beginning. You know, he's walking around thinking of how to murder people and all of this other business. I think that it's very likely that instead of being this man who's pure evil from the beginning, that this association between 666 with Solomon the Antichrist may be showing us that the Antichrist is actually a man who starts out good and then falls into evil and sin and corruption. And so this is a great principle to learn. Now, you would say, well, so what? I mean, what if it was 665 talents of gold or 667? Well, it would still have something to teach us about Solomon. Because the writer of 1 Kings gives us another warning signal here. Haven't we had warning signals all the way since the beginning of chapter 9? Here's another one. When you look at the instructions that God gave to the kings of Israel in Deuteronomy chapter 17, one of the instructions was, he shall not greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Now, God blessed Solomon with great riches, but Solomon allowed that blessing to turn into a danger because he disobediently multiplied silver and gold for himself. This was danger. He's walking in disobedience to God's command for the kings of Israel. So now let's look at some more examples of Solomon's great wealth and prosperity here at verse 16. And King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold. 3 minas of gold went into each shield. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Now these shields made a beautiful display in the house of the forest of Lebanon, but they were of no use in battle. Gold was too heavy and too soft to be used as a metal for effective shields. This is another indication here. If you're making gold shields, you want the image of a warrior king, but you're not going to fight any battles. Isn't that Solomon? Yes, I have the gold shields. Look at them. I'm the warrior king. You're not the warrior king. You're just showing off. You can't fight anything with those gold shields. By the way, according to one commentator, each large shield was worth $120,000. Each small shield was worth $30,000. Therefore, about $33 million were invested in gold ceremonial shields. And then he goes on here, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps, and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat, and 2 lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, 1 on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. All Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels in the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. For the king had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. So Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. Now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules, at a set rate year by year. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones. And he made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores, which are in the lowland. He was rich. And not only rich, but famous. I mean, all the nations of the earth seem to be bringing their wealth to Solomon just to hear his wisdom. This is fulfillment of promise after promise after promise made to the people of Israel if they would be obedient. And so he built all these cities. He accomplished all these great things. He was a man incredibly prosperous. Now, you have to ask yourself a question. Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. He gave a very eloquent testimony in Ecclesiastes to the vanity of riches, to the emptiness of wealth. You don't have to be as rich as Solomon to get the same lesson. You can learn from his lesson. Again, another warning sign. Look at verse 28. Also, Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Kevah. The king's merchants brought them in Kevah at the current price. Now a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, and a horse 150. And thus, through their agents, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. At the end of this great description of Solomon's wealth and splendor, we have another sound of a dark note. This was in direct disobedience to God. We're done with chapter 10 here. Turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 17. I want you to see this for yourself. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Okay, I want you to notice here. Let's start at verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it, and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren you shall set as a king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, for the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Do you remember verse 28 in 1 Kings 10? And Solomon had horses imported from Egypt in Keva. Command in Deuteronomy, you failed it, Solomon. Look again now at the next verse, verse 17. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Did Solomon succeed or fail on that command? Any way you slice it, 700 wives and 300 concubines, that's multiplication. It's not just addition. And then at the end of verse 17, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold to himself. Isn't this amazing? God told the kings of Israel three things to do in Deuteronomy 17. Solomon disobeyed every one. But I want you to go back here to 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 28 and 29, and notice something. I'll read the two verses again. Also, Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Keva. The king's merchants bought them in Keva at the current price. Now, a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, and a horse, 150. And thus, through their agents, exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Syrians. Do you see how Solomon would rationalize this? Well, listen, I'm importing horses from Egypt, but I'm not doing it for myself. I'm not breaking God's command. I'm just acting as a middleman. This is just a business transaction. Do you see how this way of rationalizing sin had probably taken place in Solomon's life? Rationalize sin. Pretty soon it's not one wife or seven wives, it's 700. Rationalize sin, and no longer are you just wealthy, but you're insanely wealthy like Solomon. By the way, did you notice what God said in Deuteronomy 17? He said, he shall not greatly multiply riches unto himself. Listen, God said, don't multiply wives, don't greatly multiply riches. So he said, look, you can have riches, that's fine, but don't greatly multiply them. But you can see the rationalizations going on in Solomon's mind. Well, you know, 700, a little wealthy to really wealthy. The horses, you know, I'm really not keeping them. I'm running an import-export business. But isn't that the way for you and I? Look, I know it is for me. I know in my life, many examples of gross disobedience began as clever rationalizations. You can do it. You can figure out a way. In the logic of our sinful nature, we can figure out a way to rationalize our sin. I think this is what we need to conclude with here from 1 Kings chapter 9 and 10. Listen, if a man as wise as Solomon fell under these ways of rationalizing sin, then I have to be careful too. And I think you do too.
For many of us, studying the Bible is a part of our everyday lives. There seems to always be those sections of Scripture that are difficult to understand. What did Jesus really mean when he said, "And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you"? Was Jesus literally telling us to disfigure our bodies? Of course not. We know that's not true. So what does it mean? This is where God has used men like Pastor David Guzik in the writing of commentaries. Pastor David has written numerous commentaries throughout the Bible. In fact, you can find commentary on the entire New Testament and most of the Old Testament at enduringword.com. These commentaries are available digitally at the website and even in mobile format. Concise thoughts about the history, context, and author make these commentaries a valuable resource as you seek to know Jesus more. We encourage you to log on to enduringword.com and select the book and chapter you're currently studying. Or you can purchase a copy of Pastor David's commentary for your Kindle or even a printed copy. Simply log on to enduringword.com and select books from the main menu. Another great option from Pastor David is his book, Standing in Grace. This book details the fact that those who belong to him are not only saved by grace, they stand in grace. Again, for all these wonderful resources and more, log on to enduringword.com. Well, that concludes our time together today. Please place a marker in your Bibles and make plans to join us again for the next edition of Enduring Word Radio.